This is case number 70319, and just for shortness, Grant Sahara versus Peppermill. Justice Perigieri will not be involved in the outcome of this case. He's recused. If the party's ready to proceed, please do so. Please state your name, and if you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. May it please the court, my name is Stan Johnson. I represent the appellant, MEIGSR. And initially, I think this is an important case because it deals with an important area of law, which is trade secrets. And in this day and age of increasing technology and IP, trade secret, patent law, copyright law has become very important. And one of the reasons that this is important is because it also deals with commercial ethics. And that's one of the reasons the Uniform Trade Secret Act was passed and enacted by most of the states, is because it deals with commercial ethics. And so one of the questions we have to deal with is, should we award bad actors or should we award those that act properly? And in this particular case, I think we have a fairly clear-cut situation where the initial actions were improper. They were admitted to be improper. And as the court knows, they were the subject matter of a complaint filed by the Gaming Commission, and which was heard and settled at a later point and involved a $1 million fine. So the instance of taking the trade secrets, I believe, is very clear that it was improper. And one of the things I'd like to do, though, one of the major issues in the case has to do with the definition of a trade secret. And if we look at the Act, there are two major parts of the Act and the definitions that I think factor into this case extensively. The first one is the issue of misappropriation, and that has to do with the actual taking of the trade secret and whether that was improper. And I think, as I said, that's really been established. Secondly, and what most of the briefing and arguments were really about, was the definition of a trade secret. And if we look at the definition of trade secret in subsection 4, there are two main elements that are set forth in that section. Number one, derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being generally known to and not being readily ascertainable. Now, one of the things I'd like to draw the court's attention to is that part of both of those definitions, those subparts, that talk about being. Being means a present tense situation, something that occurs at the time of the taking or the disclosure or the use. And it's interesting to note that that is used in both of those subsections. So it's important. Obviously, it's there for a reason. And as the court knows, in order to construe the statute, we have to give meaning to all of the words that are in the statute. So one of the main issues that we've briefed and we've discussed is the issue of readily ascertainable. And we have to, again, consider the fact that the statute actually says being readily ascertainable. So there's a specific reason why that is part of the statute. And when we look at the further definition of what readily ascertainable is meant to cover, the comments to the statute, to the Act, indicate readily ascertainable means or refers to examples as trade journals, reference books, and other published materials. And so that means that when we talk about readily ascertainable, that means something that is current, happening now. It has to be readily, which is either quickly or at a glance, and it has to be ascertainable. So one of the issues, one of the main issues, I think, that's been a problem with the jury instructions, which we raised, our appellate issues with, are instructions number 31 and 27. Initially, I'd like to discuss that. Under those particular jury instructions, there was references to reverse engineering in those particular jury instructions. We think that's improper and should have been excluded, because what that is really referring to when we talk about reverse engineering in the context of a trade secret is the actual discovery of the information. If we look in the misappropriation section of the Trade Secret Act and those definitions, it talks about the actual discovery of the information. Well, in this case, of course, the information was not obtained by reverse engineering. It was obtained by the actual improper taking of the information by Mr. Torres. So in this particular circumstance, we believe that allowing that to be part of those two jury instructions was confusing to the jury and was partially responsible for the improper jury verdict.
How, Mr. Johnson?
Well,
how did those instructions cause the jury to arrive at a conclusion that this information was ascertainable through other means?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that when you confuse the two sections, when you talk about reverse engineering in the context of readily ascertainable, that is confusing and misleading, because there was no reverse engineering in this case by Mr. Torres. By Mr. Torres, the pepper mill, who actually took the information. And that is when that issue of how it is discovered should be examined. If you independently come across the information, if you legitimately reverse engineer it, if you find it through some other means, then that is not misappropriation. But in this circumstance, by including that in those jury instructions, we think it was confusing to the jury.
Did the Peppermill argue at closing argument that this was acquired through a process of reverse engineering? That's not my understanding.
Well, they argued that it was readily ascertainable through mainly the efforts of Mr. Friedman, who was their expert. But Mr. Friedman was not the party that obtained the information. And that's what we have to look to see when the information was acquired and how it was acquired. Readily ascertainable has to do with the issue of the definition of a trade secret. And their argument was to say, well, there was no trade secret, and therefore we didn't take anything. They admitted they took it, and they took it improperly, but their defense really was that it was not a trade secret. But by taking reverse engineering and combining that with the argument of readily ascertainable, which it shouldn't be, we believe that confused the jury. Because the jury could say, all right, well, if reverse engineering was part of the process, and that's a proper means of discovery, then hence they could conclude that that wasn't a trade secret. So that's our main issue with those two instructions, Your Honor.
Well, is there anything in the record, though, that shows that a party argued or that the Peppermill claimed that the process, or an expert testified, that the process by which this was ascertained was through reverse engineering,
That's not my understanding of the testimony or the arguments that were made, but maybe I'm mistaken about that.
Well, when you look, though, at the jury instruction...
Your argument, as I understand it, is that these two instructions shouldn't have been given. The terms or the phrases reverse engineering shouldn't have been given, and that by giving them, it confused the jury. But I'm not sure the inquiry ends there. How? Was there some part of a party's argument, some testimony, expert testimony, in discussing how this was ascertainable that connected the reverse engineering reference in the instruction to the evidence or to somebody's argument? Well, I didn't see that, but I'm just asking you if that's the case.
I'll quickly answer that, and then my time Sorry. Is up for this section. I think, basically, Mr. Friedman's testimony did give the impression that he was arguing for reverse engineering. He was saying, these are methods that I've come up with that allow me to either ascertain or to recreate, to duplicate the information. He was saying, I can duplicate that information through these means. So in effect, he was arguing reverse engineering, and I think that's why we're very confusing regarding those two juries.
Okay.
Thank you.
Douglas, honorable members of the court. My name is Kent Robison. I represent the respondent, Michael Nelson, who from day one in the trial, three-week trial, admitted improper acquisition. Not once did we suggest or argue to anybody in that courtroom that six PARs obtained by the paper mill from the GSR were obtained by and through reverse engineering. We would have been lying through our teeth had we said that to the jury or the court. We know how we got it. We got it through the use of a 2341 theory, which is improper. But where we are today is at the intersection of the evolution of the trade secret law that from 1939 was interpreted under the restatement first of torts. And clearly, that embodiment of law stated, you are liable for use or disclosure of a trade secret if you obtained it by improper means. GSR has cited many cases that rely on the restatement first. The drafters of the Uniform Trade Secret Act define trade secret first. That is the threshold issue in this case. First, you determine whether the information obtained is a trade secret. If it does not have independent economic value because it is readily ascertainable, it is not a trade secret. Go to the second part of the equation, which is the definition of misappropriation. In order to find misappropriation, I apologize for not having an easel. To find misappropriation, you must first find trade secret. So what were the witnesses' testimony? The jury did not have to rely on Stacy Friedman. Every witness who testified in the case admitted that PARs are readily ascertainable. Their expert, Charles Lombardo, admitted that PARs are readily ascertainable by proper means. One of the proper means was that the GSR came and acquired our PAR settings through their consultant, John Stone. He plays a certain amount of coin in. He goes in and, according to his testimony, uses social engineering, deceit or deception, to look at our computer to determine the theoretical win. The example goes like this. 1,000 coin in, you see the theoretical win is $60, you know the PAR on that machine is 6%. It's that easy, according to their expert. This is not where we obtained it by reverse engineering. This is where the par itself is readily ascertainable by a number of legitimate proper means. For example, you drive down Interstate 580 in the summer of 2014, you will see the par settings of 40 of their machines referred to as Buffalo, most popular machine in the industry, incidentally. And they put the pars right on their billboard. They say, this is the lowest, we set our Buffalo at the lowest setting. All you have to do is look at an owner's manual of the Buffalo, and you see that the lowest setting is 5.27%. So they put their pars on a billboard, and in addition to that, they put their bars on their website. Same analogy. They put on their website for everybody to see that their Buffalo machines are set at 5.27%. Then they put the same billboard up for their Williams machines. They have up to 100 Williams machines on their floor. And they said, our Williams machines are set at the lowest par available. So is that readily ascertainable at a glance? It certainly is. It certainly is by the slot directors and people who work in the industry and slot departments to know what the lowest settings are on these various machines. And they publish them to the public. And they publish them to their creditors. That is readily ascertainable. Because the issue is GSR's part. Stacy Friedman emulated what John Stone does to us. What the GSR does to us by sneaking a peek at our computers to ascertain our pars, Stacy Friedman did at the GSR. But he did it ethically. He played 1,000 coin in, he walked to the VIP room and said, what is my theoretical win? And they told him, your theoretical win is 60. All he has to do is divide that coin into the theoretical win, and he knows that machine is set at 6%. Stacy Friedman testified that there are 9 different ways that pars can be readily ascertained. Their witnesses agree that the pars can be readily ascertained by what we call comp ratio. If I have a par, and incidentally, penny slots or video slots are the only machines in which pars are not readily ascertainable. On video poker, they're on the pay tables. All the par settings for craps and the table games are known pars. Even the sports books are known pars. Once you know the par of one machine, all you do is a ratio to your complement, your complementary dollars, and your free play, and you can easily ascertain the par. Do they have value because of that? None. Gary Carano, John Esquaga, John Farahi, the owners of the competing casinos in Wendover, the Bonanza, Bordertown, Calneva, the owners and operators of those casinos gave our experts affidavits saying pars are absolutely valueless. Was that corroborated by the GSR? Absolutely. Tom Sullivan was their slot director who testified for the Pepperville and said, pars are readily ascertainable. I knew that as a slot director of the GSR. I know that as an expert because I now run Boomtown, and we know pars are readily ascertainable, and they have no value, none. Not gross pars, no value. It doesn't stop there. We took the deposition, video deposition, of the general manager of the GSR. While this case was pending, Tracy Memno testified that she would pay nothing for a par. They are valueless and they are meaningless. And there's a reason why. This case is about 6 par settings that were obtained in June of 2012 by Mr. Torres. The other reports he did, some of them were fabricated, and he admitted that on the stand. And we know they're fabricated because if you look at the parts that are being reported, they're not available to those machines. And the manufacturers have not allowed that machine to set the parts at the par setting reported by Mr. Torres. So we know he fabricated some of them, but the June 2012 is legit. He got 6 parts. 6 gross parts. At that time, GSR had 1,600 machines on his floor. And the gross part,
that's, say, is 6%.
That is not what the return is to the profit. It's meaningless because it doesn't account for free play. It doesn't account for comp dollars. And so the Gaming Control Board does account for that. And every month, the Gaming Control Board publishes the net pars for the community. So we put in an ad from the Atlantis. The Atlantis says, our pars are 25% less than the casinos in Washoe County. And we got that from the gaming reports that come out every month and indeed annually. So you look at the average, say it's 8%, and here's the Atlantis, according to the evidence, advertising that their pars are 25% lower than the community average. All you do is factor the 8 by 75%, and you know their floor par. The average par for 1,600 machines is 6%. The filings of the SEC from the public companies, the Sands, the Wynn, they submit to the SEC the par settings in their 10Q and 10K reporting. So to say that there is reliance on Stacey Friedman, our expert, to go in some convoluted formula to ascertain a par is not the case. There was no reverse engineering. The fact is, every single witness called in this case talked about value, talked about ascertainability, and every single witness agreed in this case, including the Nevada Gaming Commission and Nevada Gaming Control Board, that no use was made of the Peppermill of the 6 pars obtained. No use, but no disclosure. And finally, they admitted that they did not properly protect their pars because they divulged a theoretical win. My time is up.
You have 5 minutes. I would be interested in hearing about the motion to amend the complaint. I recognize there is an abuse of discretion standard of review on it. Nonetheless, looking at this record, the motion to amend was filed 6 weeks before the first discovery cutoff, approximately 18 months into the action. And the proposed amended complaint, while it sought to add a party, also sought to improve on the legal theories under which they were proceeding to add, among other things, a civil conspiracy claim under Hotel Riviera versus Short and those kind of Nevada cases. It concerns me that that amendment was turned down, particularly in view of the technical arguments you're making, and I would appreciate your comments on that.
Thank you, Justice. I will comment. The motion was made in the spring of 2015 to amend the complaint. At that time, the case had been pending for 19 months, and substantial discovery had occurred, and we were right up against the discovery cutoff at that time. There was still some fight over the access to the emails obtained by the Gaming Control Board. And GSR wanted to add, as a defendant, John Hansen. John Hansen acted in the capacity of a representative of the Peppermill. No question about vicarious liability. No question that the Peppermill would be responsible for John Hansen's conduct. None at all. And also they wanted to add approximately 7 claims of variations, conspiracy, and others, when in fact the trade secret law almost exclusively provides that no other tort claims can be brought. There can be brought under subsection 9, I believe it is, breach of contract, where we have the trust and confidence cases of the employee, like the France case, where the employee takes the customer list, the pricing list. But there is exclusivity in the trade secret law. What we told the district court is this is a motion to continue because at this point in time, they had an expert who had been retained since 2013, Jeremy Arbor.
But they were not past the deadline in the discovery order for filing a motion for leave to amend the pleadings.
And that's conceded.
I mean, if you go to trial and it appears at trial that there's an omitted claim that the evidence nonetheless supports under Rule 15, and 54C, you can have them amended back even after the close of evidence. It really gives me pause that was not allowed.
Then let's follow it through. It was denied. It was denied in the midst of this discovery fight. So the June 6th trial date that then existed.
And it got moved. Yeah.
And was moved to July of 2015.
And then ultimately January.
We realized we couldn't get the experts lined up in light of the discovery fight by July, and we agreed to continue the trial again. And the trial was continued to January of 2016 when it took place. After March of 2015, GSR made absolutely no effort whatsoever to renew that motion because it had plenty of time to do so, plenty of time to conduct discovery, plenty of time to bring in independent counsel for Mr. Hansen and proceed with discovery, and they never renewed the motion even though the trial had been continued twice. And in their brief, they say, well, that's something Judge Flanagan should have done. He should have sua sponte, granted the motion to amend, even though we didn't renew it. They didn't necessarily want to renew it at that time, and the evidence shows, in our opinion, because the evidence was becoming increasingly clear that they did not meet these standards of the definition of trade secret. They pled trade secret, we tried trade secret, and they never asked to amend that complaint for 9 months after that motion was denied. And they blame everybody else for their failure to renew that motion to amend. If it had merit, they would have done so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless there's questions, I'm prepared to say.
Any additional questions?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
I want to quickly, before anything else, make sure I also address jury instruction number 29, which is also part of the issue on appeal. And that one, we believe, was very important for two main reasons. Number one was we argued that there should have been added to that jury instruction what we would term the language in the law from the Abbott Air case, which we cited throughout our brief, which is even that the information which was asserted to be a trade secret could have been duplicated by other means, the information is not readily ascertainable if, in fact, it was acquired by improper means. And that's almost the exact language from the Abbott Air case, which I think is very similar to this case. And what it says is, okay, if you say you can acquire this information through other means, like the Carpenter has said, but you fail to do that and you use improper means, then that is not a defense. You can't come back and say, well, 3 years later, 4 years later, because that's what really happened in this case, is according to the Game Control Board complaint, the Keene started at least in 2011. Mr. Friedman's methodology, which he developed, which he said that he developed five of these methods himself and didn't exist before he developed them, was in 2015 or 14. So we're talking about years later. And the problem is if we allow a bad actor to take a trade secret and then later come back and say, oh, 3 years later, I have some method to show that it's readily ascertainable. I've hired an expert to do that. I spent a couple $100,000, and I can now show that it's readily ascertainable. But as I pointed out, the statute says being readily ascertainable, which I think it should be at the time of the acquisition, the use, or the disclosure of the trade secret. That's what makes sense. It's not proper to allow someone to take the information, use it for 2 or 3 years, get the benefit of that information, and then say, I'm not liable because I can come back now with some expert and say, okay, it's not readily ascertainable. And that's what the jury instruction was about. The other part of it was we wanted to add the phrase, so self-revealing to be ascertainable at a glance. And that's backed up by the Motorola case, and also the DuPont case. And it's very important because readily ascertainable does mean that. It means at a glance, without a lot of work, without a lot of effort, without hiring experts, without spending years trying to do this, and then coming back and arguing about it later. Then the third part of that
which we call the corporate ethics part of it, which we believe should have been added, is that a trade secret is not readily ascertainable when the means of acquiring the information falls below the generally accepted standards of commercial morality and reasonable conduct. And that's out of the DuPont case, and it's also referenced in the comments and the notes to the Trade Secret Act. But that's really what trade secrets and the Act are all about, is we don't want to allow improper actions and those that do those to benefit from them. And that's what we have in the case. I know they talk about, you know, one par not being valuable, but that's not what the case is about. That's how they tried to frame the case throughout, but that's not what the case is about. The case is about finding out what the settings are of a competitor on their pars so they can compete unfairly in the marketplace, which is exactly what happened in this circumstance. They used that information to compete unfairly in the marketplace. If there's no other questions.
Anything additional? None. Thank you very much. Court, thanks the parties for the arguments. This matter will stand submitted. We are in recess until 2:30.